Karen Talion making a bid for AG. New allegations in the Curtis Hill lawsuit, plus the first teacher pay commission meeting, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending August 23rd, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, State Senator Karen Talion became the first Democrat to announce a 2020 bid for Attorney General. Talion, an attorney, has served in the State Senate since 2005. She's been a leader in her caucus on foreclosure and pension issues, and she's perhaps best known by many as the General Assembly's fiercest advocate for marijuana legalization. Democrats are targeting the Attorney General race next year because of what most view as incumbent Republican Curtis Hill's vulnerability. He allegedly groped four women last year, including a state lawmaker. While not criminally charged, he does face a civil lawsuit and attorney discipline. Hill already has a Republican challenger, Indianapolis lawyer John Westerkamp. Each political party will choose their nominee at next summer's statewide conventions. Is Karen Talion someone who can win the Attorney General's race? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Laura Beck, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, is Karen Talion a threat to the lock Republicans have had on the seat for nearly 20 years?
I don't think so. For a variety of reasons, but number one, most likely a Republican is going to be elected Attorney General again next year. And we have a long way to go before figuring out who the nominees will be, right? Our Attorney General, Curtis Hill, is still facing the disciplinary commission, so we have yet to see kind of how that plays out. We also are going to have a contest at the convention, as it appears. We already have one candidate who's entered that race, and potentially we will have other candidates. On the Democrat side, if Democrats really do think they have a chance at this, I don't know if Senator Talion is the candidate that they want to put up. So they may have other people get into this race. You know, she certainly would bring new issues to the forefront. She's been the most vocal person for legalization of marijuana. I think that would be a really interesting thing in an attorney general race.
Although that is starting to, public opinion on that is starting to, it's not where it was even four years ago.
I mean, public opinion on that is changing.
Is Karen Talion the right candidate for this race for the Democrats?
Well, I think she is probably one of the most tenacious candidates that's out there. I think she also is very passionate about the issues. And one of the reasons, I think, for her when you talk about marijuana is I think the decriminalizing marijuana is something that she has talked about before. I mean, there's a number of different issues out there. And she also made a great point when she filed for her candidacy, and that is that Curtis Hill, in addition to having all of the other issues that are swirling around him, he has really gambling with Hoosiers Healthcare because he is challenging the Affordable Care Act, which puts thousands of people at risk who have pre-existing conditions. So I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that we can win. I mean, in 2008, Linda Pence lost by, I think, 3 points. And that's when Mitch Daniels was running a very successful re-election campaign. So I think a lot remains to be seen between now and then.
Sure.
as we go forward.
Obviously, it matters who the Democratic nominee, but does it matter more who the Republican nominee ends up being?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's fair to say, we all know this is a pretty Republican state, and it's been very hard for Democrats to, you know, compete for statewides. But I think Curtis Hill's baggage definitely would make that seat vulnerable if he is the nominee. And that's something that Republican, you know, convention goers and are going to have to decide whether, you know, they support him or whether they're looking forward to the fall contest.
Can Karen Talion win? Okay, or maybe, can I put it this way, can Karen Talion or the Democrats win?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, we have precedent that it can occur. Now, granted, when we saw the era of, say, Jeff Modisette and Pam Carter and that. Mm-hmm. There were different dynamics. You had sort of the rise of Evan Bayh and with a very deep Democratic bench that basically, I think, when all was said and done, populated virtually every statewide office, or almost every statewide office. So it can happen, and these two things do. I'm a believer in the cyclical nature of history. Now, you know, we don't see an Evan.
We have, might not have come back around.
Well, and we don't really see cyclical. That the kind of necessarily at this point. I mean, that Evan Bayh excitement that we saw back in 1988 when he was elected. So
around a standard bearer.
A standard bearer who can maybe mobilize. But to answer the question that you initially asked, yes, I think she can. Tenacious is a great way to put it. And, you know, she was advocating, had her issues, her favorite issues, back when it wasn't cool.
Yeah, that's true.
And as you point out, Brandon, the public opinion on this is shifting pretty rapidly. And I think now you even see Republicans who have sort of softened their stance and in many cases have said, well, I'm open to this because they can read the tea leaves as well as anyone else.
Basis. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will Democrats capture the attorney general seat in 2020? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, does the Indiana National Guard have a culture problem? 71% of you say yes. 29% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, there are new allegations this week from the women suing Attorney General Curtis Hill and the state over accusations Hill groped them last year. Three legislative staffers, Samantha Lozano, Gabrielle McLemore, and Nikki DeSilva, and State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, sued Curtis Hill and the state earlier this year. They level allegations of sexual harassment and employment retaliation. A new filing in that case claims Lozano reported, quote, unwelcome and inappropriate advances by a male member of the General Assembly to the House Democratic Chief of Staff this past spring. All three staffers say they were each approached in the last couple of months by senior legislative staff who pressured them to talk about the ongoing lawsuit without their attorneys present. McLemore and DeSilva both say when they questioned that, they were told their lawyers didn't need to be there. Spokespeople for the House Democratic and Republican caucuses, as well as the Senate Republican caucus, all declined to comment.
Laura Beck, how do these new allegations change this ongoing issue?
Well, I don't think they change them at all, frankly. I think that if the allegations are proven to be true, and you are engaging in inappropriate conduct toward a subordinate, regardless of the political party you identify with, that has to stop. And what it also says to me is that this may not be necessarily a political problem, but it may be a cultural problem within the State House. And if that is the case, then that has to stop, and it has to stop now. We have an opportunity to do something about this, and shame on us if we don't.
A lot of the attention with the lawsuit and this whole issue has obviously been on Curtis Hill for a lot of reasons. But even when the lawsuit was initially filed, it wasn't only about Curtis Hill, and they said that at the time. With these new allegations sort of piling onto that list, does this start to shift the focus a little bit to the broader cultural issues at the State House?
Mm-hmm. I think it does some. I think part of what we're seeing is that these things are playing out in all the different venues that they can, right? This isn't the first phase of it. The Attorney General made it through the first phase of this. This is a different piece of litigation and kind of a different topic. I think that there are some concerns about kind of the cultural norms at the State House, and they are probably not progressing as quickly as they are in the corporate world and other places. It just historically has operated differently, and you have a lot of folks who've been there for a long time and haven't quite seen the change that's happening around us. The good thing is, I mean, there are policies and procedures in place. They are following those. You know, and it's not a partisan issue either. I mean, if you read the complaints, there's many Democrats, you know, blamed for things as Republicans. But, you know, I think the positive point here is when these allegations came out, you saw House and Senate Republican and Democrat leaders all coming in support of the women who made the allegations, all calling on the Attorney General to step aside. I mean, that kind of leadership, I think, is really helpful. And as it relates to this particular piece, it's going to be a few weeks before we see what the state's response and the caucus's response to some of these allegations are.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Is it, she just talked about how we have seen much more shift in, say, the entertainment industry at the corporate level on the sort of Me Too, what's been categorized the Me Too movement.
The rest of the world, essentially.
We haven't seen it happening quite this much at the State House. Is it troubling that a lot of the allegations in this are in response to after the initial Curtis Hill stuff came out? Yes, you had leadership from both parties saying, he's got to go, this is unacceptable. But then all of these other allegations would suggest that they aren't maybe following through on, they aren't practicing what they preach.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd have to construct a huge timeline to say when people are getting the message and are trying to heed what is appropriate conduct and speech at this point in time. You know, I think there is heightened awareness, clearly, because of the lawsuit. But if you look, a lot of those things were still sort of lingering carryovers from about the time of the incident. Is someone going to say that you can eradicate all that kind of behavior with even one high-profile lawsuit? Of course not. It's an evolution, as it has been in other industries that you cited. So I think there's a movement in that direction, but I guess I'm not surprised that you would still see sorts of, I don't want to say pockets of resistance, but pockets of conduct that is probably not ideal in what we would want to see in any setting, be it corporate, be it entertainment, be it media, be it government.
I don't think anybody expects this lawsuit to be resolved quickly. So is this the sort of thing that's going to hang over the 2020 session, or will it just not be in people's minds as much?
I mean, I think it's going to pop up every 3 or 4 mm-hmm. weeks. We're going to get new filings and new, mm-hmm. you know, new allegations, and that's what we're in for, you know. And frankly, all of this at taxpayer expense, you know. Now we have Curtis Hill fighting House and Senate attorneys that he doesn't want them involved in the case. We're, you know, filings back and forth. And, I mean, I do think it's important to note that I think if he had resigned promptly when this initially happened, maybe this lawsuit could have been avoided. I'm not sure, mm-hmm. but it certainly wasn't. So it's going to go on for months, and we're going to continue talking about it every time there's a new allegation.
The Next Level Teacher Compensation Commission, a panel tasked by Governor Eric Holcomb with finding innovative ways to raise teacher salaries, met publicly for the first time this week. More than 100 people turned out for the night of public comment in Indianapolis, and 25 people, nearly all educators, spoke, all voicing similar concerns that teaching has become an unsustainable career, leading to high teacher turnover. Many of the public commenters called for reinstating teacher pay scales, while others told the commission to raise corporate and cigarette taxes, dip into state lottery funds, and cut state funding towards private school vouchers to generate more dollars for teacher salaries. There are 2 more public comment meetings scheduled this year. The commission is expected to deliver recommendations to lawmakers for the 2021 budget writing session. Nikki Kelly, you've been following this issue for a long time now, obviously. Do you feel like we're learning anything new so far?
I don't think there was much very new things. I mean, a lot of them are personal stories that teachers were sharing. I am going to say this. I like that these teachers came with specific proposals and ideas of ways that we could increase salaries, like revenue streams. You know, I hear a lot at the State House, budgets are about priorities. And they laid out and said, look, we could use the lottery money. You know, what's the priority? Teachers' salaries or low license plates, you know, or cigarette taxes or corporate taxes. So they at least laid out some issues. And we do need to remember that, you know, every time they don't cap vouchers. I'm not even saying get rid of vouchers, but maybe cap them, you know, because they go up 30, 40 million a year. You know, lawmakers are making a choice, and that choice is not teacher salaries.
Is that going to be important in this conversation? Because it's obviously going on for another year and a half. Is that going to be important that it's not just the same message of, well, we need more money. It's, and here's how we get it.
I think so, and I noticed the same thing. And I wonder how much of that was by design. Because I think the temptation might be for people to come in and offer tales of woe, and they're all maybe very legitimate, but you're right, you can get sort of numb to that, and people can say a lot of groups have a lot of need and a lot of priorities, and you know, we just got to wring our hands and, you know, we're all going to suffer. When you come forward, though, with specific proposals, as Nikki suggested, it makes it a little tougher to say there's nothing we can do, it's out of our hands, because there are possible solutions. They may not all be feasible for any number of reasons, political realities, right, or more practical reasons. But at least now it moves the discussion to the point that you are picking among options as opposed to just saying, is this a worthy cause or not?
So they're going to have a couple more meetings in different parts of the state to try and get, you know, geographic spread on this. I don't assume we will hear dramatically different things at those meetings. So what is important for the next step to be now? Because this is still, like I said, a long process between now and the 2021 budget.
I think a couple things. One, I think this is playing out as designed. You know, the governor called for this commission. There were some questions about who should be on it in the beginning. I think that the folks who are on it are people who are able to digest all this information, evaluate it. Some of these ideas may be good. Some of these ideas are non-starters. And then they're tasked with going and finding innovative ways to figure out how we impact teacher salaries. And the one thing that everyone agrees on is that we want to increase teacher salaries. It's how do we do that? And then there will still be a debate about where that happens. And the governor, and I think most Republicans, have been pretty clear that that is still going to be a district, a local school issue, not the state setting these kind of scales. But anyway, I think that the process is playing as it should. We'll probably hear similar things in, is it Elkhart and Evansville?
I think that's right. Yeah.
And then the commission really gets to work on coming up with ideas, and then we see what we think about them.
The commission is going to get to work, and we will see what we think about them. How important will it be for there to be, and I don't know how this is going to go, I'm not saying it won't be, but how important will it be for some of that to play out as transparently as possible?
Well, I think it has to be transparent, and I think the fact that there isn't a teacher on that commission is really unfortunate, because they're the ones who are living with the reality every single day of getting promised something and then just having the can kicked down the road time and time again. Nikki is completely right on the priority piece. You basically are telling people that we're prioritizing the swine barn over increased salaries. You're basically telling them that, hey, you just hang tight. You're going to get a raise, but it's going to be in 2021. And it might be pennies on the dollar, but hey, we're going to listen to you and we're going to do this big show. So I think it's incredibly unfortunate they couldn't find the will to get this done last session. And by, again, kicking the can down the road, everyone knows. I mean, you go to a study committee to die. It doesn't come back and resurrected in some type of meaningful policy. Let's hope it does. Let's hope it's a transparent process all the way through. But I think we might have a lot of folks who may end up going to these meetings and not seeing their expectations filled or met.
Well, we'll stay on education. The attorney for two virtual charter schools, alleged to have inflated student enrollment and received millions of dollars in overpayments from the state, this week said new evidence will prove the schools did nothing wrong at all. The claim came Monday during a meeting of the Daleville Community School Board, the oversight body of the charter schools. Board members seemed taken aback and demanded to know why an attempt to counter the allegations was happening now, months after the school district raised concerns. The state is now working to recover more than $40 million after an audit found the Indiana Virtual School and the Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy exaggerated enrollment for 3 years. Daleville began the process to close both. But Mary Jane LaPointe, the virtual school's attorney, told officials they jumped the gun on charter revocation. She says, in her words, there were always more students enrolled than they were getting paid for. LaPointe handed over a few pages of new documents to the board, and without much explanation, she said Daleville officials used a brick-and-mortar analysis on the enrollment data and do not understand how virtual schools operate.
John Schwantes, what in the world is going on here?
You know, I pored over the data, and I found that during summer solstice, during the comet Cohoutek's return every 17 years with the cicadas, if you read it under a black light backwards, everything's perfect.
It all makes sense
then. You know, the operators of the school say it's there's an application here, an improper application of brick and mortar thinking. Well, and that if you use a different calendar, a different cycle, well, our schools, I mean, we got to have some structure here to evaluate programming, it seems to me, and whether that's the semester system or certain times of year where we're going to do student counts and so forth. everybody knew the rules going in, and everybody had produced documentation that the school, I mean, these operators had produced documentation that they knew going in, you know, where they came up short, ostensibly. So to be able to then say, well, wait a minute, you know, it's different than you think. And even at this point, as a practical matter, even if there were some argument to be made here,
I don't think they're going to avoid closure.
It's a fait accompli already.
The broader virtual issue aside, and I'm going to ask about that in a second, but the broader issue aside, with these two schools, it seemed like the case was shut, certainly on these two schools. Does this change that
I think it's definitely too little too late. I mean, regardless of, I don't know, the brick and mortar versus the virtual system, I mean, kids should still be enrolled in classes, right? Because a lot of them weren't. And also, I do want to note that I think this is interesting that suddenly these schools are, you know, defending themselves and acting like it's all wrong, because now we learned this week in some of the information that the FBI is getting involved, that there's a grand jury meeting.
Yeah.
So, you know, once the criminal world starts coming in, they're definitely, I think, suddenly realizing, oh, we got to work on this.
So I want to now talk about the broader virtual issue as it relates to the chaos that has erupted this week, which is at an Education Summer Study Committee meeting this week. Democrats tried to bring up they want to talk about virtual schools this summer in that committee. And Senator Rotz, the head of the committee, said, well, that's not up to me, and also I haven't really heard that much about the virtual stuff. Is that a good enough answer?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, clearly, if this is definitely a sign that there needs to be stronger oversight. I don't necessarily think that there isn't a place for virtual schools. I mean, I think there are many kids who go to them because there are specific reasons why, and they serve them very well. But at the same time, I think the legislature has responsibility to ensure that there's better oversight. I mean, there are a number of different players, and kudos to Chalkbeat for their great work on this, and as well as, you know, Nikki for the coverage you've been doing on the entire issue as well. Because essentially, that money, that's our money that should be going to our kids, and that's a real problem. So.
Can Republican leadership get away with not talking about this during the summer study committee?
Frankly, I don't think whether or not it's talked about in a summer study committee matters all that much. I mean, summer study committees tend to be pretty narrowly focused and predefined, and there aren't that many people paying attention to them.
Sure.
So I don't think that matters, frankly. But I do
that hurts
think
my feelings, that, but it's fine.
I'm sorry. I mean, we pay attention to them, but the rest of the world does not.
That's true.
I think what matters is that we do have accountability and oversight, and there are lots of different layers. I mean, Department of Education needs to be involved and have oversight. We found fault in all kinds of places in this particular situation. And so thank goodness that Chalkbeat and others did call this to folks' attention, and federal investigators are looking at all of their records, and we'll see what happens.
All right. Well, State Representative Jim Lucas, who posted nooses under a Facebook story about a black man pleading guilty to rape, has drawn criticism for what some are saying is racist imagery. Seymour Republican Jim Lucas posted a picture of a gallows with two nooses online under a story about a man who pled guilty to committing a series of rapes over 4 years. Lucas says he wanted to punish the man and believes in capital punishment. The chair of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus blasted the photo. Democratic Representative Robin Shackelford says noose imagery is well known to be connected to the lynchings of African Americans and says the normalization of racism must end. Lucas says he's previously posted the image under stories involving white offenders, and he argues he isn't racist and doesn't believe the photo is.
Laura Beck, let's give Lucas the benefit of the doubt and assume there was no racist intent here. Does that matter?
Well, this is a really unfortunate pattern of behavior that's disturbing, that continues to play itself out in a public forum. You know, Representative Lucas has known to post pictures of this type of activity. I mean, he's also known for his posts about women, you know, putting dogs and wives in trunks. And so when you have this type of behavior he also becomes very offended when we call that into question. So when you're a public figure and you have this kind of behavior, you do need to be called to task for it. And kudos to the Black Legislative Caucus for doing that. He is an elected official. He should just know better.
Nikki,
this is a pattern of behavior. Is it going to stop?
I doubt it. I will say this. I don't believe Jim Lucas is racist. I do believe he's pretty vengeful. And you know, he sees that as a good response to that rapist. But this pattern of him throwing out an incendiary meme and saying, oh, it's just funny, you know. I think as a public person, you should at least think through, could this offend certain people?
All right. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Laura Beck, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world. Working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.